Half Price Horror.
Hello, and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at Silent Hill Revelation from 2012. Written and directed by MJ Bassett, although she was credited at the time by her dead name, as this was made prior to her transition. We've talked about Bassett before in the context of her stellar work on the Ash vs. Evil Dead TV series, but this was made back when people still thought of her as an up-and-coming film director. Now, I don't want to give in to the stigma that film is somehow more significant or more important than television, because that's nonsense, but it is true that film gives the director more input and control over the finished work, and that tends to mean that directors with a particular vision they want to realize gravitate toward film. The person with the power in television tends to be the showrunner, which is why they're called the showrunner, although they're usually given a formal credit of executive producer, which means something entirely different in film. Because Hollywood's not confusing or anything. That distinction between film and television directors, and the associated stigma, as unfair as it is, makes a difference here, because I think if you were to give this movie a casual glance from the direction of 2024, you might think, oh, they didn't bring back the original writer or the original director, it's got a budget less than half of its predecessor, and they got some TV director to do it. This had to be a quickie direct-to-DVD cash grab, right? But in fact, this was intended to be a straight-up contender for some real box office returns, and Bassett was seen at the time as scoring a big success by landing the project. But what happened to Roger Avery and Christoph Gahn, the original writer and director? Well, initially they were all about diving right back into the world of Silent Hill, but things stalled out over the next couple of years as Gahn got involved in an adaptation of the video game Onimusha that never got off the ground and clashed with producer Samuel Hadida over the direction of the film. According to a 2020 interview with Allociné, Gahn said they were pushing to make it more like the Resident Evil franchise that was coming up on its third installment at the time, although I will note that I had to rely on Google Translate here because my high school French is a little too rusty to just plow through an entire conversation. When Gahn left, Avery went with him, and although the producers tried to lure him back, those efforts ended after his 2009 sentencing for vehicular manslaughter, which I touched on during the episode on the first Silent Hill. The project then languished for a while until 2010, when Bassett was brought in to direct. According to a 2018 interview with her for the podcast The Movie Crypt, one of the pointers she was given was that fans weren't happy with how the first film diverged so far from the video game, so she made it one of her core responsibilities to more directly adapt Silent Hill 3. I know what you're thinking, why 3? Because Silent Hill 2, the first video game sequel, is an almost entirely unrelated story with a whole new cast of characters that happens to be set in the same town, and it made more sense to go with a plotline that picked up where the first one left off. The upcoming film Return to Silent Hill, which is directed again by Gahn and is aiming for an April 2024 release date, is based on Silent Hill 2. So Bassett wanted to connect the first Silent Hill movie to the third Silent Hill game. And this is where I go into a little more depth about the first Silent Hill game than I did in the episode on the first Silent Hill movie, because a lot of the problems with this film stem from that effort to stitch up the mythology, and it's genuinely important to understand the changes Gahn made in a way that it wasn't when you were watching a not entirely faithful adaptation and the work needed to stand on its own. So in the first movie, just as a refresher, the inciting incident took place in the 1970s when a religious cult called the Brethren, composed of the town's most influential citizens and led by a woman named Christabella, decided out of fear and intolerance to burn a small child named Alessa, whose powers and abilities seemed otherworldly and supernatural, even though there's a good chance they were actually gifts from God. Alessa survived, but she was scarred both mentally and physically and let the devil into her heart to help her get revenge on the Brethren. She tore Silent Hill out of reality altogether, creating a dream version of the town that occasionally became a nightmare for its surviving inhabitants, and split her soul into two parts, sending the innocent and loving half of herself out into the world to lure in a good person named Rose to Silent Hill so they could enter the innermost sanctum of the Brethren. With that sanctum breached, Alessa killed everyone who had wronged her and allowed Rose and Alessa's other half, Sharon, back out into the world. although they remained trapped in the dream version of reality created by Alessa. But in the first game, the Brethren were a cult that worshipped some ancient and horrible supernatural deity, and Alessa was deliberately birthed by her mother Dahlia to be the vessel of that deity. The cult burned Alessa to purge away her mortality and allow the unholy god to emerge, but Alessa prevented it by deliberately bisecting her soul and sending the other half away. Silent Hill, which remained in the real world, occasionally felt the influence of Alessa's nightmares and transformed into a terrifying alternate version of itself, but it was still a real place where real people lived. In the end, Dahlia tried to finish the ritual by merging Alessa with Cheryl, Alessa's other half, but she was saved by Cheryl's adoptive father, Harry, and allowed to live her own life again. Depending on which ending you got. The Silent Hill series is known for its alternate endings, including a joke ending in every game involving gray-style aliens. So basically, you have two sets of motivations for the cult that are mutually contradictory. You have two different versions of the actual town of Silent Hill that are accessible in different ways, you have two backstories behind Alessa's powers and abilities, and you have two different fates for the cult and its members. Also, you have two different protagonists and two different names for the innocent half of Alessa, the game is about Cheryl's dad and the movie is about Sharon's mom, and two oppositional sets of motivations for Dahlia. That makes it a pretty tall order to resolve the two, and I think you're going to see how a lot of this film's problems result from the attempt. But who's involved in this Return to Silent Hill, not to be confused with the upcoming movie Return to Silent Hill? Well, we do get a few returning cast members. Sean Bean comes back with an expanded role as Christopher De Silva, although he's now going by Harry Mason to throw off the pursuit of the cult, who are now known confusingly enough as the Order of Valtiel, which is a reference from Silent Hill 4. Rhoda Mitchell also returns as his wife Rose, although her role is reduced to little more than a cameo, as is Deborah Kara Unger's reprise of her part as Alessa's mother Dahlia. And because he's practically the mascot of the franchise, Roberto Campanella comes back for a second turn as the Pyramid Head monster, this time credited as Red Pyramid. I've already gone into the careers of all four in my episode on the first Silent Hill movie, so I'd recommend checking that out for more details, and honestly, it's probably just a good idea in general, as this one really relies on you remembering that film. Which was probably less of a good idea when there was a 6-year gap between the two, but hindsight is 20/20. Joining the established cast is Adelaide Clemens as both Alessa and the now 18-year-old Sharon, well, 17 and 51 weeks or so, going by Heather to throw cultists off the scent. Clemens got into acting around the time the first Silent Hill movie was released, with a regular role on the short-lived TV series Pirate Islands, The Lost Treasure of Fiji, and a major part in 2011's taken-with-a-twist horror movie No One Lives, before she was cast in this film. She's since gone on to a nice career of regular work in movies and TV, with appearances in The Great Gatsby and Under the Banner of Heaven, a true crime series that could just as easily have been classed as horror. It's about two young Mormon men who train themselves to open their minds to direct revelations from God, only to find that God apparently wanted them to kill their sister-in-law. It is genuinely one of the most unnerving books I've ever read. Appearing as Heather's friend, and please don't think about it too hard, love interest Vincent is Kit Harington, who just exploded onto the scene a year earlier with his role as Jon Snow on the hit TV series A Game of Thrones, alongside Sean Bean, who played his father. The critical failure of this film didn't diminish his rising star, and this movie made its money back at the box office, which is more than you can say for the first one. And he's gone on to appearances in MI5, voice work in the How to Train Your Dragon movies, and a minor role in the Marvel movie Eternals that teased bigger things for his character. He played Dane Whitman, known to comics fans as the Black Knight, but he didn't get his signature ebony blade until the post-credit sequence. Playing Vincent's mother and the villain of the movie, Claudia Wolfe, is Carrie Ann Moss, who got her start as a working actor and day player in shows like Forever Night, Nightmare Cafe, The Hitchhiker, and Street Justice before going on to much bigger things with Matrix. This was, of course, a short-lived TV series from 1993 about a hitman who died and came back to atone for his evil acts by helping people and... oh wait, wrong Matrix. She was, of course, Trinity in the 1999 movie The Matrix, a role that single-handedly elevated her above her previous work in Models, Inc. and FX The Series to make her a female lead with her choice of projects. She reprised her part as Trinity in three sequels, as well as appearing in the classic neo-noir movie Memento, showing up in the Netflix Marvel shows Jessica Jones, Iron Fist, The Defenders, and Daredevil, and doing the zombie movie Fido, among many others. She's definitely what you'd call a get for this film. Appearing as Claudia's father Leonard is the man, the myth, the legend, Malcolm McDowell. We've already talked about him in the context of his role in Rob Zombie's Halloween movies, but it bears repeating that he's the man you go to when you want someone to feel larger than life in every sense of the word. He's worked with Stanley Kubrick in A Clockwork Orange, with Brandon Cronenberg in Antiviral, and with Rachel Talalay in Tank Girl. And although his part here is a small one, little more than a cameo in some senses, he definitely lives up to his billing. And because Jodelle Ferland had aged 6 years since she filmed the original Silent Hill, making her utterly unable to reprise a child's role, and unfortunately Bassett ruled her out for the adult Heather due to her lack of resemblance to the video game character, we get Erin Pitt as young Sharon and young Alessa. She doesn't really get a lot of screen time here, certainly not enough to establish her as a performer rather than a body double, but she's continued working since then with recurring roles in The 99 and Mike the Knight, as well as in movies like Against the Wild and Isabel Dances into the Spotlight. I think it's safe to say she doesn't have Ferland's enthusiasm for the genre. With that, I think it's safe to begin. And we start after the usual profusion of studio logos. Okay, I like the way the Davis Films logo crumbles into rust as the sirens of the Brethren blare. We get the opening logo, burned into old concrete as ashes float up around it. The theme from the previous movie begins to play, but it slows to a stop like an old worn-out record as we come in on what's very obviously Heather's nightmare. I'm going to call her Heather for consistency's sake, even though she's actually Sharon from the first film under an alias, and sometimes characters do refer to her by that name. She's trapped in a grotesque parody of an amusement park, with bloody-mouthed stuffed bunnies and dead goldfish as carnival prizes. I'm genuinely surprised that this isn't a weird old-timey reference that no one would get nowadays, but apparently some carnivals do still give out live goldfish as prizes for the games of skill, and they usually wind up exactly like these fish by the end of the day. Well, not actually like these fish. Apparently they used a special chemical to harmlessly stun the fish so they'd sink to the bottom, and when it wore off they were fine. Heather runs to the carousel, which begins to spin up as a ring of cultists approaches her, and when she looks, it's Pyramid Head, hand-cranking the machine into motion. The horses become gagged and whimpering people in bondage gear, and the last thing she sees before she wakes up is a sinister, white-faced version of herself with dark hair and black lipstick who says,
"You cannot defeat me. Do not go to Silent Hill."
Just before immolating the entire crowd and finally Heather herself. It's worth noting that one of the most unfortunate decisions regarding both Heather and her alter ego was the decision to make them frame-accurate versions of their video game selves. The costumes have a very simple color palette, and the hair in particular looks so emblematic of early 2000s video games that it gives the lingering impression that Adelaide Clemens is herself a computer-generated sprite who's just mo-capped into the frame, even though she's very human and very real. And it creates a persistent sense of unreality that doesn't help with immersion or verisimilitude. Just had to get that off my chest. Harry comes in to comfort her as she wakes, telling her that her nightmares are just the product of moving into a new place and a new town, but he's then stabbed in the back by a chalk-white figure with blades for hands who looks like she stepped straight out of a Hellraiser movie, and we realize that, oh yes, of course we're going to get the old double dream fake out. I don't know why this has become so standard now, but I'm honestly more surprised when we get just one at this point. Also, the CGI blood in this scene looks especially cartoony. I don't mind CGI effects, but this felt like something they could have done practically just as easily with only a few minor changes in staging, and it would have looked a lot more convincing. Then again, this was shot with 3D in mind, and it might have been very important to get the blade coming straight out of the chest and right at the audience. As with virtually every other 3D movie I've ever heard of, Bassett commented on how difficult and restrictive it was to shoot in the format. Heather scribbles down Silent Hill, the last remnant of her dream, before we cut to the morning where a Pop-Tart coming out of the toaster provides perhaps the world's most pointless jump scare. At least they had the restraint not to film it from above so it could launch itself at the audience in glorious 3D. Over breakfast, Heather and Harry have a brief expository conversation about the constant moves from city to city and the constant changes of identity, and we're treated to Sean Bean's improved but still fairly shaky American accent. It's not that he doesn't sound American, it's that there are lots of American accents out there, and he's chosen one that sounds like a working-class Pittsburgh truck driver when he's supposed to be a wealthy businessman on the run. It's just a little jarring, that's all. He sends Heather off to school and gets on with his important day job of tearing pages out of her dream journal so she doesn't get too curious about Silent Hill. Which leads us to yet more exposition, as Harry has a flashback to the memory of when he was still calling himself Christopher, and Rose appeared to him in a mirror, explaining that she found a portion of a magic seal that allowed one and only one of them to escape from the dream world they were trapped in. She chose Sharon and charged Christopher with keeping her safe from the cult in Silent Hill before vanishing back into the mists and leaving him to make up a lie about a car accident that claimed Rose's life and left Sharon with amnesia. Now, I know this sounds very clunky and ham-fisted, and frankly, that's because it is. The decision to place Silent Hill in a dream world dimension and to trap both Rose and Sharon there instead of sticking with the game's concept of Silent Hill as a real place that sometimes turned nightmarish created a beautiful and haunting conclusion to the 2006 film, but it did kind of leave the writer of the next installment stuck in a corner when it came to matching things up to the start of the game this movie is based on. As a result, there's an almost audible beeping noise as the story backs its way out of the plot cul-de-sac to get things to a point where the narrative can progress again, which isn't exactly anybody's fault. Bassett didn't have any great options that didn't involve a clumsy retcon, and Gunn certainly can't be held responsible for not leaving things open for a sequel he never intended to make. But it's nonetheless a very awkward and lurching start that's so heavy on the info dumping that they might as well have made a title crawl before the action began. Heather heads to school, and there's a momentary jump scare as she sees an unhoused man briefly transform into a faceless monster shortly before a mysterious figure approaches to ask her some questions she definitely doesn't want to answer. But she evades him by getting onto the bus and into the school where mysterious strangers aren't especially welcome. We then get some more exposition, with Heather telling her new class, and by extension the audience, that she moves around a lot, she's not interested in making friends, and she'd probably forget everyone she's talking to in a few months even if they weren't all boring. This quiets the room a little, but it clearly intrigues the other new student, Vincent, who looks like he's 26 and speaks with an American accent that makes Sean Bean sound like a native. And I mean, there's good reason for that. Kit Harington was 26 when he made this movie, and he's an actor from West London who's so British his ancestor on his mother's side tried to blow up King James I, and his ancestor on his father's side was King James I. Supposedly. I haven't done any genealogy studies or anything, but that's what he claims. To be blunt, he's deeply miscast for this role, and even though he tries very hard, it's clear that he's focusing so much on the technical aspects of getting the accent right that he can't really emote convincingly. I think that they'd have been better off casting an American actor closer to the age of the character, unless they're trying to hint that he's lying about being 17, which is perfectly possible given everything else he's lying about, or at the very least coming up with some hand wave to explain his natural accent like they did with Heath Ledger in 10 Things I Hate About You. Heather experiences another moment of surreality in the hallway between classes, with all the other students disappearing in the classrooms playing out scenes of Alessa's persecution from the first Silent Hill, and she winds up briefly in a nightmarish, ruined version of the school with an armless man pursuing her before reality snaps back to normal and Vincent asks her what's wrong. And again, this is a point where the differences between the original movie and the original game come back to haunt the sequel as it tries to thread the needle between them. In the game Silent Hill 3, it doesn't really seem like a big deal that Heather is being transported back and forth between this reality and the nightmarish other world, even when she's outside the town of Silent Hill, because they didn't make such a point of emphasizing that Silent Hill is its own reality with its own rules. But here, it raises a lot of questions that the film isn't prepared to answer. Heather ditches Vincent, blowing off his attempts to befriend her, and it's only on the second viewing that it becomes distractingly obvious how much Kit Harington's outfit resembles the one Han Solo wore in The Empire Strikes Back, but after school when she leaves, she sees the mysterious figure from earlier and calls her dad for advice. He tells her to go to the mall where there are plenty of people around and he'll come get her, but as he leaves the house, he's accosted by some sort of a monster and the screen cuts to black. In the Silent Hill 3 game, he was killed in order to draw Heather to Silent Hill to seek revenge, but Adelaide Clemens doesn't really seem like the avenging angel type, so it was wisely changed to a kidnapping. Even so, the attempts to stay true to the game's storyline means Sean Bean's not going to get much to do beyond be tied up and look worried for the rest of the movie. Heather waits at the mall, where a bunch of adorable kids dressed like clowns are having a birthday party in the mall food court for a little girl who happens to share her alias. But the balloons change from Happy Birthday Heather to Happy Birthday Alessa, as we finally and fully descend into the nightmare world. And I will say, Bassett doesn't skimp on the horror when we finally get it. The various diners and the clown children are still themselves, but they're now chomping down on bloody hunks of raw human flesh with expressions of sadistic glee that are downright terrifying. The stranger shows up, pursuing her, and Heather ducks into the back of the restaurant where she sees Butcher slicing off chunks of tissue from meat-hooked but still very much alive human beings before she flees even deeper into the employee-only areas. And down by the dumpsters, the man catches up with her and reveals himself to be Douglas Cartland, a private investigator who's been tracking her for months on behalf of a mysterious employer. He assumed it had something to do with a man Harry killed in self-defense back in Portland, but in fact his employers are the Order of Valtiel, and they want him to bring Heather back to Silent Hill, and her dad's been lying to her about the cause of her amnesia, and we're right back into info-dumping territory again. I kind of feel like this should have been a warning sign all the way back at the script stage that some of the complexities of the story needed to be trimmed, or else that they needed to entirely reconceptualize the whole thing instead of building it on the back of Silent Hill 3, but sometimes you don't know how something's going to flow until it comes together as a finished work. Also, how does Cartland know that Harry lied to Heather about her amnesia? Sure, if he's a very good detective, he might have somehow found out about the story Thomas Gucci told in the first movie, and maybe, just maybe, he learned who the Order is and what they're after, as well as their name, but Harry specifically told Heather the story about the car accident, and neither one of them spread it around. I don't think this was really thought through beyond, well, scenes where someone reveals to the protagonist that everything they knew was wrong are cool, so let's put one in here. Just as Heather's denying the story, the blade-handed creature from her dream shows up, chopping off Cartland's fingers before the two of them barricade themselves in the freight elevator to escape her. This creature is called the Missionary in the game Silent Hill 3, although it's never named that on screen in this film, and it's gender-swapped for reasons we'll get into later. They try to ride the elevator to safety, but the Missionary gouges its way through the top of the car and murders Cartland stone dead. In the game, he lives a lot longer and shows up periodically to offer handy exposition, but most of his function in the story is instead given to Vincent, and he's mainly here as a nod to the fans. I think they probably could have cut him out entirely. Heather escapes, shucking her bloody jacket and leaving it behind. IMDb makes a point of mentioning that the jacket has an undercoat underneath which she's wearing a vest, underneath which she's wearing a hoodie, underneath which she's wearing a shirt, but the movie is very obviously set in winter, so I think it's very smart of her to dress in layers. She realizes she's come back to the real world when she gets all the way outside the mall and finds herself on the wrong side of police tape. The cops are there investigating the murder of an out-of-town private investigator, and they quickly shoo her off into the crowd. As she wisely and unobtrusively makes herself scarce, Detective Santini and Cable, played by Jefferson Brown and Milton Barnes, find her bloody coat and begin the work of identifying its owner, which is going to be remarkably easy for them, but we'll get into that soon enough. Vincent finds her as she's walking away and decides to accompany her to keep her safe as they get on the bus. Shaken by her ordeal, Heather asks Vincent if he believes there's a difference between dreams and reality, and Vincent overshares that his grandfather used to believe that, so his overbearing mother had him committed. And I feel like the biggest problem with this scene is that because we haven't had any dialogue in the first half hour that wasn't exposition, this doesn't have anywhere to hide to keep it from becoming a big obvious red flag that Vincent is way more involved in the plot than he's letting on. Especially because he just says, in my hometown, instead of naming a place. In a movie that maybe had a little more room to breathe, this might have just been something you could slip past the viewer, but here it's one more bullet point in the cliff notes we're getting in preparation for the third act. Heather leaves Vincent behind and goes inside and finds the sigil of the Order and the words, "Come to Silent Hill," written in blood on her wall. She races around the house calling for her dad, which is enough to bring Vincent back as he's walking away, and the two of them hide as Santini and Cable show up with remarkable alacrity to haul Heather in for questioning. I suppose they could have gotten a physical description of her from the mall security cameras and gotten her name from someone in the crowd who recognized her from school, but even then, the leap to finding her house in such a short period of time is pretty amazing. They get there almost before she does. They burst the door down, which seems remarkably forceful entry for someone with such a tangential connection to the crime, and there's a weird moment where they see the blood on the walls and say, "How's that for probable cause?" Which would indicate that they just broke in without a warrant, so this is yet another movie that's pro-ACAB. Luckily, Heather and Vincent are able to grab Harry's big box of top-secret Silent Hill memorabilia, which she apparently knew about but never thought about going into, and they get away from the cops by the simple expedient of cutting directly to the next scene where she and Vincent are driving away to Silent Hill. I'm not even joking. They show the cops standing in the living room, there's an edit, and then it's Vincent and Heather in the car. There are so many questions this raises and doesn't answer that it's genuinely kind of infuriating. Either the cops are a trivial obstacle, in which case why involve them? Spoiler alert, they do not show up for the rest of the movie. Or they aren't, in which case why not have some sort of action sequence explaining how Heather evaded them? The actual answer, as you might imagine, is that there's a whole chunk of the film missing around here to get it down to a tight 94 minutes. According to IMDb, Heather and Vincent were going to get arrested, only to escape when the police station also turned otherworldly and the detectives were killed by the missionary same as Cartland. Which makes sense, because all the supernatural entities are there to make it easier for Heather to get to Silent Hill, but apparently they thought it was more important to get the runtime down so we get this not even hand wave to move us along to the next plot point. As they drive, Heather goes through the big box of Silent Hill memorabilia, which again, you'd think she would have been curious about before because it took her so little time to find it that she can't have been oblivious to its existence, but no. And she finds a letter warning her to stay away from Silent Hill and all of Harry's research about the cult. According to this info dump, Silent Hill was a prison colony built on, sigh, ancient Native American burial grounds, because that's a racist trope we really needed to bring back in 2012, and it was run by a mysterious cult known as the Order of Altiel, who believed that they could bring their god to Earth as a physical being by birthing a human child to act as a vessel and purifying its mortality with fire. They failed, and Alessa punished them by trapping them in a nightmare world ruled by her and her personal protector slash executioner, the Pyramid Head. She doesn't actually call him that. It's not a name that inspires terror. Now, this is obviously a huge retcon from what we saw in the previous film, and one that really doesn't fit with all the established backstories and motivations of everyone involved. Christabella's motivations were very clear, very straightforward, and very emphatically stated. She thought Alessa was evil, and she wanted to burn her to death to protect her town from that evil. Suddenly trying to spin it as the actions of a bizarre cult who wanted to bring their god to Earth as a living being feels very much like a case of, who are you gonna believe, me or your lying eyes? And it does make it a lot harder to enjoy the movie for anyone who is legitimately invested in the story we already knew. And it's sad because really it wouldn't have taken much effort at all to make this work. All they needed to say was that Christabella and the Brethren were the unwitting pawns of the Order, and they were being manipulated into cleansing Alessa under the guise of destroying her evil. Claudia doesn't need to be Christabella's sister, spoilers, and they don't need to be one big group that just happens to have two sanctuaries and two diametrically opposing explanations for events. The old, oh, but you didn't know that the end boss was only the pawn of an even worse end boss trick is hoary, yes, but it could have worked here. Instead, Vincent and Heather stop at a motel just inside Silent Hill, which is for some reason still opening with functioning electricity, and a weird shoe decoration over the beds that's incredibly distracting and is apparently an Easter egg for the fans. As soon as they're settled in, Vincent tells Heather that he thinks she should abandon her dad and run, because this has all clearly been arranged to lure her to Silent Hill, which leads us to, you guessed it, yet another info dump, where Vincent explains that he's been lying to her all this time and he's actually a member of the Order himself. Kit Harington's full body lunge as he makes this dramatic reveal is so cheesy, it's downright adorable. He escaped the town through a handwave ritual, and he was tasked by his mother with the job of luring her back, but he feels guilty because Heather is a sweet and innocent soul and he doesn't want her hurt. There's a whole bunch more to this monologue, mainly papering over all the plot holes I already mentioned, and it's all just exhausting after so much of the movie has been filled with exposition already. We don't even really get a chance to settle into Vincent as a character before we learn his big dark secret because he's done nothing but info dump. It's very frustrating. It thankfully ends when Heather and Vincent descend into the nightmare realm, taking the entire motel room with it. The most important part to remember is that Heather has half the seal of Metatron, and the other half is with Vincent's granddad in the town asylum. He is also Heather's granddad too, something it's unfortunately very obvious that Bassett either completely forgot or hopes we did. By establishing Christabella as Claudia's sister, they also establish her as Dahlia's sister because Christabella and Dahlia are siblings in the original film. And Dahlia was Alessa's mother, and Alessa split herself into two halves, of which Heather is one. Which also means that Heather and Vincent are cousins, which makes their vague romance incestuous and squicky if you think about it for even a moment. The Seal of Metatron does figure into the game as well, by the way, and it's named after an angel from the Talmud who's been incorporated into Christian Apocrypha as the voice of God. Voice in the sense of spokesperson. So presumably the intention here is that the bearer of the seal speaks with the authority of God's own voice. Which is nice and all, but it doesn't really explain what it does in the story, and it's kind of obvious that it was chosen simply because they needed a magic item to do stuff, and Seal of Metatron was a thing that already existed in the lore. The missionary shows up, capturing Vincent and knocking Heather out, and when she wakes up, the room is normal again, but she's in the foggy netherworld of Alessa's dream. Because I guess she's close enough to be in Silent Hill, but not close enough that it counts as coming of her own free will if the missionary drags her the rest of the way? Ignoring the fact that you had to come of your own free will is just another fridge logic handwave there to explain why the cult hasn't kidnapped her earlier if they knew where she was. I have come to admire the audacity of simply stating a rule authoritatively without explaining it and counting on the actor's conviction to smooth over the gap in logic. Heather gets her dad's handgun and the seal and goes marching into Silent Hill proper, which, by the way, now has an amusement park and a mental institution in addition to the hospital from last time, so it's clearly a pretty bustling place for something you can walk the length of from end to end. She bumps into Dahlia, who, you guessed it, info dumps a full recap of the previous movie for anyone who came to see this with their friends and didn't watch the first film. Sadly, Dahlia's awesome dark crystal chic aesthetic from the previous installment is gone, and she's just wearing a green dress and looking mopey. Also, I hope you enjoyed that mock Super 8 look of all the flashbacks last time out, because they just reused that footage without a hint of shame. I try not to be snarky at this, because I do want to respect the hard work that goes into filmmaking, but man, this is the halfway mark of the movie, and I think it's been 90% people explaining things so far. The darkness comes again, and Heather looks for a place to hide, and if there's a single saving grace to this movie, it probably comes in this sequence. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, mind you, because it was originally intended to be part of the Nightmare Mall section of the movie, and they just wholesale moved it so they could speed the film along to Heather's arrival in Silent Hill, but I don't care because it's just so freaking cool. Heather goes into an apartment complex and finds herself without warning walking into a stockroom full of mannequins, one of which is still breathing inside its plastic bag. As if that wasn't bad enough, and it is, she sees a naked woman lying on a table, and before Heather can do anything, a wave of transformation washes up the stranger's body, turning her into a lifeless plastic mannequin, starting from the feet and working all the way up to the top of her head. They don't actually show her vagina sealing over. I understand that would have been a bridge too far in the eyes of the MPAA, but I feel like the sheer unearthly terror of watching someone get turned into a Barbie doll would have been perfect in the most awful way. Heather then finds a teenage girl cocooned in plastic pallet wrap that's been twisted and tangled into a kind of webbing, and she has just enough time to pull her free before up in the webs, something that looks like a collection of random mannequin parts begins to shift and crawl like a monstrous spider in their direction. It's got at least 3 heads and at least 4 legs and at least 5 arms, and you can see muscle and bone underneath the smooth white surface at every joint, as though there's some sort of biological entity inside there using all the parts for protection, like a horrible hermit crab from your worst nightmares. It crawls over to the body on the table and twists its head off, joining it to its own agglomeration of anatomy as it awakes with a scream. And frankly, this is the kind of shit I come to horror movies for. I could have watched a whole feature about this. The girl, who's listed in the script as Suki and who's played by Heather Marks, has just enough time to explain that she took a wrong turn and wound up in Silent Hill before they're desperately fleeing the mannequin creature. And again, that doesn't make sense because that's not how people get into Silent Hill, and this was all supposed to be taking place in the mall, and this was supposed to be a set piece with the mannequins from a clothing store, and in fact, Suki was supposed to be an entirely different girl played by Jackie Lai, who was seen briefly in the classroom scene at the beginning making fun of Heather's outfit. This was going to be her comeuppance. But they did the best they could to make it all fit, and I'm so glad they did because this is definitely, oh hey, new phobia just dropped territory. They make it into a ventilation shaft just as one of the creature's doll heads opens up down the middle to reveal a ring of teeth around a mouth that then extends another mouth like the xenomorph in Alien, something that makes a lot more sense now that I've listened to Bassett talk for 2 hours and know that she idolizes Ridley Scott. The two girls escape, and then Suki doesn't, as she's dragged back into the room like Angela in Wreck. But Heather gets away. Vincent's fate, meanwhile, is revealed when he gets a lecture from Claudia, who, don't get me wrong, I get that the character in the video game has long white hair and chalk pale skin, and I understand you might want to kind of recreate that aesthetic, but the wig looks cheap and fake. I'm usually fooled by wigs of all shapes and sizes, but even I could tell this was something you'd get at a Party City for Halloween. And because Carrie Ann Moss isn't naturally pale, they just layered clown white onto her until she looks more goofy than menacing. You can almost picture the rest of the order glancing back and forth at each other, wondering who's going to be the one to tell her what kind of an impression she makes. Claudia decides that Vincent needs a spell in the town's mental institution to cure him of the delusion that Heather is pure and innocent, and takes him away. Coincidentally, Heather comes out of the maze of ventilation shafts just across the street from the asylum, and after a slightly tedious sequence of flashlight grabbing and key hunting and map consulting and monster shooting and journeying through darkened hallways, she finds a blind man dressed in rags chained in the center of a private cell. And you know damn well Malcolm McDowell's not gonna try an American accent, not when he needs his mouth nice and wide and expressive to devour every scrap of scenery. It's more info dumping, of course, this time about parallel realities and cult politics and Vincent's whereabouts and the Seal of Metatron, but Malcolm McDowell makes a meal out of it the way no one else in this movie can. Frankly, they should have given him all the exposition and let everyone else find other things to do with their time. And he uses his exposition to convince Heather to let him examine the Seal of Metatron, only to shove it inside his own body to join the other half already there. That unveils his true nature, a grotesque monster that's impervious to gunfire, and he easily overpowers Heather and slings her over his shoulder to deliver her to Claudia. But in a moment of heroism that's pretty clever and honestly unexpected given how much time she's been spending just listening to people deliver speeches, Heather pushes her hand into Leonard's chest and drags the now whole seal back out. He disintegrates. Originally he was just going to revert to Malcolm McDowell, which would have solved some plot holes later. And Heather goes looking for Vincent. She's stymied by a passage full of raging inmates who reach through the bars to grab her, but just then Pyramid shows up, because he's Alessa's protector and I guess Heather's close enough, and slices off every reaching hand with his massive blade. And man, there is nothing like the way Campanella carries himself in this costume. Heather finds Vincent just as he's being wheeled into a room full of the puppet nurses from the first movie, and I kind of like the implication that the Order uses them to lobotomize their wayward members by forcing them at the point of a cattle prod to perform only as much surgery as is strictly necessary for the cult's goals. But like the soldiers in Day of the Dead and the Romero zombies, they prove lethally difficult to corral, and soon the two gas-masked brethren who brought Vincent in are dead on the floor. And although the murderous monsters react only to sound this time instead of light, Vincent can't free himself from the gurney without attracting their attention. But Heather likes him in ways we're trying very hard not to think about, and she helps to free him so they can both escape. I'd say this sequence helped to inspire A Quiet Place, but we both know they're borrowing from 1972's Tombs of the Blind Dead. The two of them head to the town's amusement park, where the true sanctuary of the Order is located, and naturally it looks just like Heather's dream from the beginning. They're being pursued by the Brethren, which is now specifically defined as the enforcers of the Order who wear gas masks because they're afraid of being contaminated by Alessa's darkness, and Vincent sacrifices his newfound freedom to draw them away because he likes her too, in a way we're trying very hard not to think about. One of the Brethren nonetheless finds Heather, and there's apparently something to that fear about contamination because the moment she pulls off his gas mask, he collapses to the ground retching black bile. But of course, this is all just a prelude to the moment from her dream where she goes to the carousel and confronts Alessa at last. As before, the dark version of herself destroys the pursuing cultists in a wave of flame, before warning Heather that she's not afraid to destroy Heather's purity because she no longer feels anything but hate. But Heather believes that love is stronger than hate, and she embraces Alessa and owns the darkness within herself at last. It's a moment that would work a lot better, I think, if Alessa didn't look so comically emo, and also exactly like the kind of palette swap you get in video games that are trying to add characters without adding a lot of 3D modeling work to the budget. She's Player 2 Heather, basically, and it's just hard to take seriously, even though on paper it should be a big event. It turns out that the carousel was actually lowering into the ground with each rotation, which I do think is a very neat idea for a secret entrance that I kind of wish someone else would use. And also, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that from overhead it looks kind of like the Umbrella Corp logo, which is just confusing. Heather goes deeper into the secret sanctuary to find Vincent and her dad being held captive. Claudia is all about forcing Heather to embrace her destiny as the vessel of the cult's god, but Heather touches her with the seal of Metatron and shows that inside, she's been a monster all along. Claudia transforms into the missionary, which I think is intended to demonstrate that her spirit went out into the world to kidnap Harry and kill Cartlan, and I'd complain that this isn't especially clear, but the last damn thing I want at this point is another exposition sequence. Pyramid Head shows up to fight the missionary, who does not disintegrate into dust even though she's no longer touching the seal, and although she's faster than he is and inflicts plenty of wounds on him, it doesn't really matter. He's an expression of Alessa's will, as powerful as he needs to be to punish her tormentors, and he finally decapitates her to end the power of the Order once and for all. The three protagonists head back up into the world, still foggy and dreamlike, but now without the constantly falling ash that symbolizes Alessa's burning torment, and Harry takes the seal and tells them he's going to find Rose and use it to get them both out. Which bugs me, because she's supposed to be here in Silent Hill already, and Radha Mitchell was cast in the movie, so why not bring her back in the third act to do something, and then have them all go back and give the family a happy ending? As it is, this just feels like a very pale imitation of the ending to the previous film, and I couldn't really bring myself to care much about it. And in a final Easter egg slash sequel setup for the fans, once Vincent and Heather are ejected into the real world, they hitch a ride with a trucker named Travis Grady, played by Peter Outerbridge, who mentions he hasn't gone near Silent Hill in a long time. This is a reference to the Silent Hill prequel game, where Travis Grady helps save Alessa from the fire that burned her, and presumably that would have been retconned too if they'd done something more with the franchise. But instead, they just drive away as a whole convoy of police cars head in the opposite direction, which I thought was a reference to the detectives from earlier still looking for Heather, but no, that's from the game Silent Hill Downpour, where a prison convoy crashes in Silent Hill and the convict escapes only to be trapped in his own nightmare world. All of which is a lot to dump on the audience in the last minute of the film, especially if you're not a fan of the games and haven't played all of the installments they're hinting at for the next movie. That may go some way to explaining why there wasn't a next movie. Bassett wound up in what she called director's jail for a while after this, moving to television to get work due to the negative reviews this film received. Thankfully, she seems to have been released for good behavior, and this year sees her helming an adaptation of Red Sonja that feels right up her alley. But ultimately, I think we didn't get a sequel because unlike Christoph Gahn and his controversial entry, this movie tried to please everyone and wound up pleasing no one. And will I hang on to this movie? Honestly, I shouldn't. Despite some lovely directing flourishes by Bassett and a couple of gorgeous sequences of surreal terror, this is kind of a bust thanks to the non-stop exposition that fills up the first three quarters of the movie. But I love that mannequin sequence a hell of a lot. And the mall cannibals are intense too, and I think I might just hang on to it for that. For now. Against my better judgment. And if you want to talk about mall cannibals, grotesque spider-crab-mannequin hybrids, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as Half Price Horror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, it's time to bid farewell to Freddy Krueger, folks. But as we all know, the last nightmare is also the newest. So let's get meta with the weirdest, most inventive, Wes Cravenest of all the Nightmare sequels, Wes Craven's New Nightmare. See ya then.